different Delta Delta Zero hotel to handle this piece.
C and Q are used for a general call saying, I'm calling anyone. Calling anyone, is there anybody out there?
Many of the discoveries that have been made by amateur radio operators.
There is no trouble finding an Elmer in any radio club who's going to get you on the air.
Providing communication in the event of the loss of all of public service communications.
N0JPH, November 0, Juliet Papa Hotel, calling CQ, CQ, CQ. This is N0JPH.
Amateur radio, also known as ham radio, is a hobby and a public service that allows licensed participants to operate communications equipment. It began in the late 1800s with the experimentation and development of wireless transmission. No one is exactly sure where the term ham comes from.
Amateur radio is the sort of correct technical term. It's the term you'll see in federal law and federal rules. Ham radio is a slang term, and nobody really knows where it came from. The general feeling is that telegraph operators and radio telegraph operators back in the 1910s and 1920s would complain about the fact that they were trying to send a message and they'd be interfered with by amateur radio operators, because in those days anybody could broadcast on any frequency. They began to refer to these amateurs who were interfering with their important, they thought, communications as hams.
Basically, no one knows. There's different theories about it. The one I hear the most, or I've read about the most, is there were three people, one of them was a woman, actually, who were hams, and they used their initials of their first name, I think, or maybe last name, to come up with the term ham and start calling themselves hams.
Ham is, it's kind of a slang term. I was told that it derived in the, you know, the early days of ham radio, early 1900s, just hamming around. That's what I took it to come from.
There's a lot of debate about that. It harkens back to, as a lot of the amateur radio terminology does, to the old telegraphy days. Telegraphers prided themselves on their fist, and that's how well they could send Morse code. And amateurs who were just learning how to do that were accused of being ham-fisted, and it was sort of a slur, so they called them hams.
In the history of ham radio, there is an explanation, and a viable explanation, for almost all of the jargon that's used, and there is a lot of jargon, but nobody can seem to really clearly identify where ham comes from. The one that I've heard most often is that it's sort of a slang for amateur, hamateur, but I don't think anybody really knows.
The radio man plays an important part in maneuvering. His fighting weapon is the transmission key.
My name is Emmanuel Block. I got started in amateur radio when I was 10 years old. Eventually, I began to build my own one-tube radios that could both transmit and receive. And even though we were not licensed, we could transmit and receive to each other over short distances, which we did. We were called bootleggers. And I was on the verge of taking the license test when Pearl Harbor came along. I worked on all the radio and radar and electronics on the airplanes we had on the aircraft carrier. In July of 1946, I finally got my license. I've been active on and off. I've built a lot of equipment ever since that time. I've belonged to the St. Paul Radio Club now, I think, since 1951.
My name is Janice Rabideau, and I became interested in amateur radio in high school.
My name is Janet Rabideau, and I got involved in ham radio with Janice. We did it together, which we did most things.
My sister Janet, her call letters, by the way, are K0JE, and I am K0JA. We're twin sisters. We became good friends with one of the hams in the Minneapolis Radio Club. It was a neighbor of ours. We would bike over to his place, and he would help us out to learn radio and the code.
In the 30s and 40s, the high schools in Minneapolis, all of which had radio clubs, the club was centered at the YWCA, I believe on LaSalle and 8th Street, and it was called the Kilocycle Club. After World War II, a number of the people that had belonged to that club began what's called a network, where at a certain time on a particular frequency, everybody gets together and talks about whatever people talk about. I've belonged to that net probably for 10, 15 years. But now it's down to just the two of us. So there's myself and the fella in Wichita. He's 90, I'm 88. We're the remnant of many, many high school kids who belong to that Kilocycle Club.
We have been licensed amateur radio operators for 60 years. We were licensed in 1953. What we actually prefer currently is CW or code operation, and we are members of the Minneapolis Wireless Association, which is a contesting club, and we operate contests.
Initially, all radio was amateurs. There was no such thing as professional radio. It was all experimenting. Amateur, if it means anything, means experimentation. Many of the discoveries that have been made by amateur radio operators because of their numbers and the probability of discovering something accidentally or purposefully.
We do have a 60-foot tower, and it has several antennas on it, which we use depending upon the band or the frequency we operate on. Amateur radio is just not one band like CB. It's a number of bands, and it goes from very low frequencies to very high frequencies.
As time went on, as more people were attempting to use radio frequencies, there was more and more interference. It was chaotic. The Department of Commerce established rules and regulations and assigned different frequencies. By the late 20s, things were pretty orderly, pretty much the same as we have now. As the hobby grew, other countries established amateur radio societies. There's a worldwide affiliation now of amateur radio societies.
Amateur radio, when we started, was relatively primitive compared to what we now experience. At that time, it was AM and code. The code hasn't changed that much. Then soon after that, something called sideband came on. Also, the licensing requirements were changed. We have what you call extra class licenses, which are the top grade. It required 20 words a minute of code and 4 levels of written tests with the FCC.
When we started out, there weren't very many women radio operators.
There was a degree of discrimination, as you'd expect. If we went to some of the clubs, all that they would expect us to be able to do would be to make the coffee and work with the wives in the kitchen or be the secretary.
And we did meet a few very good operators that were good friends of ours, and they helped us a lot to be integrated with the clubs.
The amateurs, by the way, were the first ones to use what we now know as a cell phone. We call them repeaters, and they're still around. What we did is began to put stations up on the top of high buildings, and the station would receive the low power signal and then would retransmit that at a higher power level. So with just minimal equipment, you've got about a good 30-mile radius just by walking around or riding a bicycle and using this handheld and using one of the repeaters. Well, this evolved into the cell phone system, because when the commercial side discovered that this is a very good way to communicate, cell phone usage just exploded.
International Morse code is what we use. And when we first started teaching ourselves code, we thought you'd used it by dot, dash, dot, dash. And SOS is dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, dot, dot. So that's the wrong way. You have to do it as dits and das. Otherwise, you can't get the sound when they start sending you the sound. So it's dit, da, 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 dit for SOS.
By 1946, the only piece of equipment we had that was not a tube was the crystal from a crystal set. By the end of the 50s, we were beginning to see solid-state components, and eventually there were only a few tubes in the equipment, and finally those tubes disappeared. Now everything is solid-state.
As part of the hobby, there are many operators who enjoy building their own equipment, teaching classes, and helping new enthusiasts to obtain their license from the FCC.
My name is Alan Klein, and I live in St. Paul. I'm 60-plus years old. Back when I was a kid, my father had a college classmate of his who lived about a half a block away from us. And the fellow happened to be a ham radio operator. He taught me the Morse code, which back in the 50s and 60s was a requirement to get a license. And then he built me a receiver and transmitter and gave it to me and said, "Now, you see if you can use this."
My name is Orsina Lyle Orsi, W0QT, Whiskey Zero, Quebec Tango. I've been a ham about 12 years. I always knew about ham radio, but I could never find anything out about it. When I was a child, I'd ask people and they'd say I couldn't do it. The St. Paul Radio Club is my main club. I was president for 4 years. Before that, I was vice president for 2 years, and I'm very active in coordinating one thing or another.
I build transmitters, devices that send signals out into the airwaves, and I build receivers, things that allow me to hear signals coming from other people. I've never had a fancy tower or a fancy antenna. I've always had just wire antennas strung in the backyard or around the house in various places. And those wired antennas oftentimes need to have a device that allows for the efficient transfer of power from the transmitter to the antenna. And that's called a tuner. And so I built an antenna tuner.
I like building things. I learned how to solder and I learned how to build electronic projects. That's one reason I wanted to get into ham radio, because I like to do things like that. Currently, I'm coordinating a circuit builders group for the St. Paul Radio Club, where we meet and build things. Sometimes we have quite a few people and sometimes it dwindles down to one or two, but they want to learn. If anyone wants to learn, I will help them, because a lot of people helped me.
My name is Twyla Greenheck, and my radio call sign is N0JPH. I'm involved with the St. Paul Radio Club, and I got involved in amateur radio in 1988. I decided to teach and coordinate classes so that others could study for their FCC exams and become hams. And in 2000, I was elected to the position of vice director of our three-state area for the ARRL. The other aspect that I was really interested in was taking amateur radio to young people. So working through St. Paul Radio Club, we sponsored a electronics class at Washington Technical Magnet Middle School, introducing children at that age to electronics. We set up a radio station and powered it by a wind generator, and then we got them on the radio and assembled fun little electronic gadgets, and actually they made their own radios.
Hams have really made great progress in the field of radio. A lot of things we have been invented by hams or promoted by hams. For instance, during World War II, someone named Hedy Lamarr, actually, a movie star, she was an electrical engineer, and she came up with a new invention, got a patent on it. It was called spread spectrum technology. It enabled someone to talk to someone else on ham radio without anyone being able to listen in, because it hopped frequencies all over the place, and the receiving radio was also set up the same, so it could hear, but no one else could. And that helped us during World War II in getting intelligence out without anyone knowing about it on the other side, the Nazis. She got a patent, and where she got the idea for it was she had a friend who was an avant-garde pianist. She was listening to him play one night, and he was just all over the place, and that gave her the idea to jump the frequencies in radio all over the place. It's used everywhere now. Everyone has it because it's such a good thing. But at the time, you know, it didn't exist at first.
I was surprised that there were very few women hams. As a matter of fact, I was sometimes the only woman in the room. I had no idea this would be true, and men are just wonderful, but I did miss the feminine companionship. And missing that feminine companionship, I founded a women's group of ham radio operators. I did that in about 1993. We disbanded in 2000. In Minnesota, there are 12,300 licensed amateur radio operators right now. There's about 52 clubs. And among all of that is about 1,800 women, which would be about 15%.
And it's interesting that with the advent of more and more portable technology, the demand for frequencies has been very intense. And now sometimes the government is auctioning off frequencies for millions and millions of dollars. They still maintain these amateur radio allocations, even though some of them are very, very valuable, in exchange for amateurs agreeing to become technically knowledgeable and be available in the event of war or other demand for technologically trained people, and also for amateurs to provide public service for disasters and also for races and whatever.
Public service and emergency communications are an important part of being an amateur radio operator.
Reports that the entire town is underwater.
My name is George Power. My call sign is Kilo Zero Golf Charlie Papa, or K0GCP, and I got started in amateur radio in 2009. I've always been interested in emergency preparation. I've had 12 years with the Red Cross as a disaster technician. My involvement with emergency services, public services, is through ham radio, as part of a group called ARES, A-R-E-S, or Amateur Radio Emergency Services. I belong to Washington County ARES. We are serving agencies such as Catholic Charities or the Salvation Army or the Red Cross as their communications arm in case of a disaster.
My name is Ralph Bierbaum. My amateur radio call sign is known N0AWN, or phonetically November Zero, Alpha Whiskey November. I've been licensed now for 36 years. I guess I got the bug back when I was in grade school, and used to listen to AM broadcast radio from all over the country, and never lost that thrill.
My name is Janet K. Bierbaum, and my call sign is KD0BZZ, and I got involved in amateur radio because of my husband, who has been involved for many, many, many years. I went to class. I went secretly. And it was his 30th wedding anniversary present that I got my license. Then he found out before I could even call him. But he was a little shook up when he called me at work to see if I had really actually gotten a license. Never in the world thought I would ever get a license. So that's how I originally got it. But moving on, I'm using it every day of my life. I use it volunteering. I use it talking to many people, including him. I'm a Skywarn weather watcher now. I went to that training. I have my own equipment. I have my own radio in my car, and I'm having a lot of fun with it.
There's two emergency management groups of hams, one that's organized on the national level that is organized by the amateur radio operators called the Amateur Radio Emergency Service, or ARES. And then there's a government version of that that was organized under the old civil defense system called RACES. I belong to a RACES group that is part of the Anoka County Emergency Management, and we form an auxiliary technical corps. We start off as communicators, providing communication in the event of the loss of all of public service communications.
In my case, I do almost all of my operations mobile, which means I'm set up in my car. As befits someone who is doing emergency work, I need stuff that I can transport easily. I have knockdown antennas that will fit in the car. When I reach a site that I'm going to be working from, I can put an antenna up on the roof and run 50 feet of cable down to the shelter inside where the radio will go. Most of my radios would fit in a relatively medium-sized briefcase. Then I need to carry a couple of batteries as backup if I don't have electrical power available. We are prepared basically to work the first 48 hours with no electricity.
The National Weather Service formed a cadre of spotters. They needed someone to go out and look at the sky and verify what they were seeing on radar. We're the people who go out, use our amateur radio, look at the sky and say, yes, that's a wall cloud, yes, we have rotation, we have hail, we have wind of a certain speed, and that gets transmitted immediately back to the National Weather Service. Well, I've been doing it since 1985.
In my job as a registered nurse, which I've now retired from, I was the safety officer, and they were installing amateur radios in all the hospitals because in the event of an emergency, like when the 35W bridge went down, boom, we were out of cell phone. It took the cell phone completely down because there was way too many people on their cell phones, and it overloaded. We only had amateur radio for transporting to the local emergency hospitals. But now, because of Katrina and all of the growth of Homeland Security and how emergencies are treated now, every hospital is to be equipped with an amateur radio station. And therefore, they have to require somebody to have a license.
We do a lot of public service things. Our big event is the Multiple Sclerosis MS-150 bike tour, which is a two-day bike tour from Duluth to Minneapolis. We run the Communications Command Center there, and we have almost 100 radio operators that are involved in that.
Mike Stapp. My amateur radio call sign is Kilo Echo Zero Whiskey Whiskey, and I got interested in radio when I was about 7 years old. I'm a member of several clubs that have a focus on what's called QRP, running no more than 5 watts. I'm a trained weather spotter, and I'm a part of an organization called International Health Service of Minnesota. The mission of that group is to go to the country of Honduras twice a year and bring medical and dental care to really remote places in Honduras that typically have no medical staff nearby. They don't have a clinic nearby. A lot of times these areas we go to have no electricity, no roads. They have no domestic water supply. One of the functions I have when I go there is to be a radio operator. I relay messages from our team to the other 7 or 8 teams that are in the field.
Today, many ham radio stations include digital equipment in their communication system.
Keith Miller, and my call sign, by the way, is Alpha Golf Zero Hotel AG0H. And I got involved in ham radio back in 1978 when I first took my novice test and obtained my license. Over the past 30 years, I've tried many different facets of ham radio and found them to be very challenging and fun. The main club that I'm involved with right now is the Stillwater Amateur Radio Club, and I also belong to the St. Paul Radio Club and the Southeast Metropolitan Amateur Radio Club, which is known as CMARC.
My name's Henry Kinane. I got involved in ham radio in summer of 2005 through the Cub Scouts. Just turned 12. They have this event called Jamboree on the Air, or JODA, and it's where amateur radio operators and Boy Scouts America get together. So my call sign's a KC9IMC. Like basically talk around the world rather than just the local FM repeaters. What I've recently gotten into is searching for what ham radio operators call DX. And DX is our long distance contacts, other countries.
And the DX cluster actually lets you know if there's DX on the air from other amateur radio operators. So if I work a fella in Vietnam and I have a good contact, I can enter that information into here and let other amateur radio operators know what frequency they're on right now. And this thing is updated constantly every half minute. Let's say you are looking for a distant station that someone else has worked, but they're very hard to get. They rank these stations by easiest to the hardest to get. Like a station in China might be way up towards the top of the list to try to get them. And they're not on very often. That's how they get up so high. Well, I can put that call into that DX summit, into that cluster, and it will make a noise when he's on. If somebody reports that he's on a certain band, this will let me know.
There's a big ham radio contest, a worldwide CQ contest for the voice mode, single sideband. So there's a lot of countries on, and a friend and I, we worked a lot of Europe, a little bit of Africa, some of Saudi Arabia.
The fun thing that I enjoy is the digital technology. I like to listen to all the funny little sounds, the coded messages that are really on the forefront of technology, all generated out of a computer and run through a sound card to the radio. You can generate high-resolution images, you can generate messages, you can have just discussions back and forth with other radio operators, all from the keyboard of your computer.
And what makes this possible is the sound card in a computer. It hears these tones, and it's capable of separating one tone from another, from another, from another. And we use the program to take these tones, show them visibly to us, and then we can click on which ones we want to listen to.
But I think the big thing is to have, you know, a supporting friend who's in it. I think that helps a lot. And I was fortunate to meet some really great people who are very willing to, you know, help me out. I'm a college student. I can't operate out of my dorm room because I'm pretty confined space, can't antenna. Individuals got back to me. They're like, oh, well, you can come over to my place and you'll operate using my equipment. There's a lot of good people in the hobby.
Phase Shift King PSK31. It's a digital op means of communication. It's operating on 14.070.15 megahertz. It automatically decodes what they're sending. The computer screen looks like railroad tracks coming down, and you center the graticule over that, and it automatically decodes what they're sending on the other end. And this fella here says, nice signal into Ohio. Rig is a Kenwood TS930SAT. He's now listing out what kind of antennas he has.
What we use is a computer that controls our radio, and you'll use that to send the code. And through that way, we've contacted a lot of people worldwide.
Ham operators enjoy sharing their knowledge, and there are a wide variety of amateur radio organizations and clubs.
Nationally, there's about 700,000 amateur radio operators, and we do have a national organization of hams. It's called ARRL, and it's headquartered in Hartford, Connecticut, and it's been there since 1914, and they sponsor contests and educational opportunities, UST, their magazine, many other things. Mainly, the ARRL deals with national and international policy.
To me, I've always been a ham radio operator. Hamming it up, that's always been part of the thing. And, you know, ham radio in Minnesota has been going on a long time. We have several clubs that were formed here in the 20s and early 30s, and all are still active today.
St. Paul Radio Club is the oldest radio club in the St. Paul area, founded in 1931. St. Paul stays a general purpose club. There are other clubs, for instance, the Stillwater Area Radio Club, that specialize mostly in long distance radio, the Twin Cities FM Club, specializing in FM radio. There are some clubs that specialize in microwave transmissions for doing slow scan TV. Almost any topic of radio can be a topic for the club to discuss. Basically, if a person looks up on the webpage and finds out what the club is doing, and if the club is doing something that you are interested in doing, you simply show up at one of the meetings. They're not closed meetings. They're wide open. They'd be very happy to have people show up.
The thing about amateur radio is there's always an Elmer. An Elmer is a mentor, and they're always called Elmer. There's an Elmer who's going to give you a piece of wire or a digital headphone or something to get you going. There is no trouble finding an Elmer in any radio club who's going to get you on the air.
And one thing we do that I gave a program on was what we call fox hunting. Actually, you're looking for a hidden radio transmitter. Someone hides the radio transmitter. You can do it in a park, or you can do it in anywhere. You could do it where everyone's driving and looking for it. It might be 30 miles away. And it's interesting because you learn a lot about how antennas work and about how the signal works. You get close to the transmitter and it goes crazy. You overwhelm your radio and the radio can't handle it. So you have to attenuate the signal one way or another. And the signal will bounce off of water towers and buildings and hills. So it can give you totally wrong readings. It's really fun.
We have an activity every year. It's called Field Day. It's practice for operating in the field, emergency operations. In every town, you're going to find somebody operating Field Day. It turns into a big contest. See how many contacts you can make. But it's going up and setting up out in the field. And we learn through that how to prepare for emergency operations. We had a situation where we had an antenna, but we had no place to put it. So what are we going to do? Looked around, found an extension ladder. I made a tower out of it. Three pieces of wire, guided up, up it went. We got on the air with it.
Once a year, we go up to Split Rock Lighthouse, and we do a Remembering the Edmund Fitzgerald special event. And we go up there on the first weekend of November, and we set up our communications gear in the picnic shelter just south west of the Split Rock Lighthouse. From Friday afternoon through Sunday evening, we try to contact as many stations as possible. We get about 20 to 25 people that come up there every year, and it's a good get-together. It's a lot of fun.
And this one particular net called the Maritime Mobile Net actually serves mariners. There are so many of us that congregate for this net that somebody's going to hear that little boat out there, especially if they're in trouble.
I wear two hearing aids, and my deafness is hereditary, and they make such wonderful digital equipment now, and digital headphones. Even when I'm working the radio, I can hear it, and it has been helpful to me to listen to radio transmissions. They can be clearer than having a conversation with a person in the same room, especially if there's some music on. But radio is available to hearing impaired. It's very much available. And as a matter of fact, it's a great alternative to trying to use the TDYs, and those are hard.
I think it was in about 1963, the Handy Ham organization was formed, and it was formed by a group of nuns down at Rochester, Minnesota, the Sisters of St. Francis at the convent down there. They got together and organized a group that would help handicapped people reach outside their little rooms where they were all closed up and become hams and be able to operate on the radio. And they became an organization under the umbrella of Courage Center.
Where they are today, it's now the Kinney Foundation.
Now they have merged with Sister Kinney. But they are still an active group. They help also with the handicapped people being able to get computers. And computers are a big part of being on the air these days, too.
So I would say there's these two major aspects to amateur radio. One is the social, the other is the technical. And some people lean one way, some people lean the other, others are in the middle. And there are so many things one can do with amateur radio that people seem to shift from one to the other.
You never know who you're going to run into on the radio, and that's probably one of the big things is you just be open to talk to people, you know, just tell them about yourself and, you know, see where it goes.
I have talked with amateur radio operators all over the world, and it's taught me so much and has brought a richness to my life that I can't imagine experiencing any other way.
I think the reason that there are still over 700,000 amateur radio operators in the United States and tens of thousands here in Minnesota is that there is a magic to the uncertainty of who you can talk to and how predictable it is. There is a certain excitement that comes from listening to people in some cases far off lands and then being able to communicate with them.
73 is simply a shorthand for goodbye. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And 73, I'm clear. I'm out of here.
From the beginnings of wireless communication to today, amateur radio operators continue to experiment, educate, engage in public service, and lead the way to new technology. This is Dixie Treichel for KFAI.
7-3.
Miniculture on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.